Today, we are continuing our study in the book of Joshua with that section that when you say Joshua, pretty much everybody thinks about. You know, Joshua fought the battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. That is that section of Scripture. It is an amazing event in the history of the world. But yet the fact that it is so amazing makes it difficult to speak on. We have to kind of work a little harder, since most of us are very familiar with that story and that passage. The temptation is just to hear it and let it go soaring overhead as we sit and think about, you know, our grocery list or, you know, what we're going to be doing later on in the afternoon and so on and so forth. But we just have to do maybe a little bit of work on the familiar passages in order to get down into what's exactly going on. So I said last week that we're going to actually take a running start at this and not start with chapter 6, verse 1, because that's really starting, as we said last week, that's like saying, the section at the end of chapter 5 is like saying, and the Lord said to Joshua, and stopping there. That's not fair, so you have to really read the whole thing. And it starts back in Joshua 5, chapter 5, verse 13. It was after that first Passover, after the whole nation had reconsecrated themselves to serving God, they had renewed the covenant, they had circumcised everyone who had come out of, who had been born during the wanderings of the wilderness. Everybody, probably 39 years of old and younger, circumcised. They celebrated the Passover together. The manna stopped. So now they were in the land. So now what? They camped out on this plain. And in front of them is this fortress, an ancient fortress of Jericho. It had gone back thousands of years here in this country. If something's 100 years old, it's old. Europeans laugh at us, but in the Middle East, it's even worse than that. I mean, Jericho went back for thousands of years earlier than that. And there it was. So I guess if I was Joshua, my first question would be, what now? You know, God has promised us that we would take this thing, this fortress. Verse 13, now it came about when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries? He said, no, rather, I indeed come now as captain of the host of the Lord. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and bowed down and said to him, what has my Lord to say to his servant? The captain of the Lord's host said to Joshua, remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. And Joshua did so. I find this very fascinating and something that we need to take to heart. Because Joshua came and asked this being, are you for us or for your adversary? And the answer was basically neither. And that's the question that we need to look at in our own lives. Certainly from a larger standpoint, everybody wants to say, God is on our side. Well, no, he's not. I don't care what side you're on, God is not on your side. The bigger question is, are you on God's side or not? Are you going about God's program? God is the one who is in control. You see, to say that, because I was thinking about this, to ask if God is on your side, it implies that you have come up with this program and you've come up with this idea, this course of action, and now that you got it all planned out, you got it on the whiteboard, you got lines drawn and block diagrams and everything else, and you got it all set and ready to go, then you turn to God and say, well, what do you think about this? You in on this?
Yeah.
That's not how it works. I'm sorry. It's not like God's sitting there, you know, talking on the phone or whatnot, and you just tap him on the shoulder like, hey, you know, what do you think about this? No, I'm sorry. as far as God's plan for how this world is going to conduct itself, or even how your piece of it is going to work, you're not the one making the plan. That may be news to some people, but you're not the one in charge of making up the plan. God's got the plan. Question is, are you going to be on the right side of his plan or the wrong side of his plan? See, if you're on the wrong side, God's plan is going to include squashing you like a bug. You can be part of that part of that. You can be that part of the plan, or you can be a part of the plan that involves, you know, victory. And the shouts of joy and victory resound in the tent of the people of the Lord. Right? You can be part of that shout of joy. Or you could be part of the people, part of the ones that the people of the Lord are rejoicing over. Or you could be some of the ones sitting at the edge of the camp, scratching your head, wondering what just happened. Which, you know, I've seen too. You know, what's that phrase? You can either be behind him or alongside, but if you're in front, you're going to get run over. Well, God doesn't really have beside you, and you don't really have behind. It's like you either have to be part of the plan or part of the problem. Right? But even if you're part of the problem, that's a plan too. But the plan is how to deal with the problem. In other words, God's got it all wired. It's like you can't escape it. You can't say, "Well, you know, I'm going to opt out of your plan, God." Well, no, you can't do that, because God's plan is all encompassing. It's not like he's got the plan for everybody in the world except for Pete. You know, Pete's got his own plan, so we're going to let Pete do what he's doing while we work out this plan for the other, you know, 5 billion people in the world. But, okay, Pete, he can do his own thing. No. That's not how it works. You are part of the plan. The only question is, what part are you going to play in the plan? You can play the successful part or the not-so-successful part. And Joshua got that message really fast, really quickly. Because once he figured it out, Joshua fell on his face to the earth and bowed down and said, "What do you got to say to me?" In other words, what is your plan? What should I do? Instead of concocting something and telling God, "Great, I'm glad you're here as a representative of God. Let me show you what I plan to do. And what do you think of that?" No. That's not how it works. This captain of the Lord's host, we're not exactly sure. It's not really clear. You know, we as, you know, scientific thinking Americans want to slant this in. Well, who is it? But it is very clear. We get into chapter 6 that this was a manifestation of God himself. All right, so let's flip over to chapter 6 and continue. There's a parenthesis added here. Now, Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel. No one went out and no one came in. See, that was the problem. That's why Joshua was able to stand there gazing at Jericho, scratching his head, saying, "Now, how am I ever going to deal with that thing? It's all shut up. The fortress is shut tight. It's well defended. We're not going to get in." They didn't have explosives in those days. So once you had a fortified city that was secured like that, you weren't getting in. I mean, you could use, later on, I don't even think they, well, maybe they did in those days, to have siege ladders and things like that, but even that was chancy, because the people inside the city had a big advantage of the people outside. They could just, you know, knock the ladders down. So it would have meant, considering the size of the Jewish army, they could probably have taken Jericho, but had huge casualties, immense casualties, which would have weakened them for the rest of the Canaanites all around. Verse 2, the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and the valiant warriors." If I were Joshua, my first thought would be to look around and say, "Where?" Because it's still, it's over there, it's all shut up. But yet God could say, "It's done. Problem solved. This is what you do." Verse 3, "You shall march around the city, and all the men of war circling the city once. You shall do so for 6 days. Also seven priests shall carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. Then on the seventh day you shall march around the seven cities seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. Shall be when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and all the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people will go up every man straight ahead. That's God's plan. I'm sure that wasn't Joshua's plan, but then he wasn't God. God simply said, you see all those walls, don't worry about it, I'll take them down. Then you just march right in and take the city. Sound like a plan to you? Sounds like a plan to me. And I know if you've been around here any length of time for the holidays, you've heard the shofar, and you know it's not a pleasant sound, it's a blast. So imagine what it was like to be in the city and watch this all happen. Verse 6. So Joshua, son of Nun, called the priests and said to them, take up the Ark of the Covenant, let seven priests carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord. Then he said to the people, go forward and march around the city, and let the armed men go on before the Ark of the Lord. So it was that when Joshua had spoken to the people, the seven priests carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward and blew the trumpets, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord followed them. The armed men went before the priests and blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the ark while they continued to blow the trumpets. But Joshua commanded the people, saying, you shall not shout, nor let your voice be heard, nor let a word proceed out of your mouth, till the day I tell you, shout, then you shall shout. So he had the ark of the Lord taken around the city, circling it once, then they came into the camp and spent the night in the camp. Now Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the ark of the Lord. Seven priests carrying the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord went on continually, blew the trumpets, and the armed men went before them, and the rear guard came after the ark of the Lord, while they continued to blow the trumpets. Thus the second day they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. They did so for 6 days. Imagine being in the city. You know, you wake up in the morning. There they come. Whack, 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 whack. Rat, rat, and then they're done. Done for the day. I imagine the first day, everybody just braced for the attack, and they picked up their weapons, and they said, all right, the Jews are coming, get ready. And we just went back to the camp. And they're looking at each other saying, what was that? What just happened? Second day, brace for the attack and get ready. Once again, walk around the city one time. You know, maybe the king's there on the wall by that point. He's kind of following them along on the wall, looking down, like, what are they doing? And then, you know, then they're gone. Maybe by about the fifth or sixth time, people didn't even look up. It's like, yeah, they're just doing what they're doing. Didn't anybody get their weapons or anything? All right? You just kind of watch it happen. It's kind of interesting to watch God working in these ways, because there's some subtle things here about how God works in our lives, too, because that very first time when this commander of the forces of God came to meet with Joshua, he could have just said, all right, get your guys together this afternoon, I'll take the walls down, you march right in. And that would have been it. So you say to yourself, well, what in the world is going on with this march around the city for 7 days? And why in the world are all the people involved shouting? God didn't need the shout. God didn't need the shofar blast. He didn't need anything. He could have just taken the walls down. Just peel them off like you peel an orange, and the people march right in. I think, you know, God desires us, and it's a great wonder to me that God involves us to be part of the work of His kingdom. Even nowadays, God could do wonderful things all by Himself. Wonderfuller things or more wonderful things than He could do with us. But He chooses instead to work in us. Because just as here with the ancient Jews, it wasn't just the question of taking down the walls and conquering Jericho, but rather that God's name would be glorified and that the people would trust in God. So the way you get people to trust in you is by getting them to participate in what's going on. So they had to participate. They had to do something. It also increased their faith in God, because really what they were doing was, on the face of it, pretty stupid. You know, I mean, if God wasn't involved with this, the whole idea of somebody walking around your city carrying this golden box, blowing these ram horns trumpet once a day, and then going back home again, that's pretty stupid. It's only the power of God that made it work. God asks us to do some things that the people around us laugh at. You know, praying, you know, things start going awry in our life, or even before that. Things are going well in our life. And we stop, we say, oh, you know, I gotta stop and pray. People look at us and say, why? That's stupid. I remember when I first became a believer. It was right after we were married, and our finances, like every newly married couple, weren't doing all that great. And a friend of mine who wasn't a believer, we sat down and we were talking about finances, and he was asking about what our budget looked like, and he said, well, maybe he'd try to help because his father was in business for himself, and he maybe had some advice for me. I described all of it, and I said, oh, and you know, this is the money that I give to the Lord. And he said, well, I can't help you if you give your money away. I said, oh, sorry, that's not negotiable. By the way, he eventually did become a believer, and shakes his head whenever he thinks of that comment, because he remembers it too. He remembers that conversation. But there are other things that we do. And when things start going badly in our lives, we can dive in like the people around us, or we can stop and say, well, what am I doing wrong? What am I doing wrong from a human standpoint, but how am I walking away from the Lord? This stuff's got to be going bad for a reason. What is that reason? It might be something totally unrelated that people around us would laugh at. But it works. It works. Also notice that although he was on this mission from God, sending these people around the city, he still sent an armed guard around it. I mean, he had faith, but he wasn't stupid. He figured, well, God didn't tell me not to guard the guys, so I'm going to guard the guys. You know, there's still some reasonable precautions that he made. All right, verse 15. Now on the seventh day they rose early at the dawning of the day, then marched around the city in the same manner seven times. Well, on that day they marched around the city seven times. At the seventh time, when the priests blew the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. The city shall be under the ban. It and all that is in it belongs to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot and all that are with her in the house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban, so that you do not covet them and take some of the things under the ban, and make the camp of Israel a curse and bring trouble on it. But all the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord, and they shall go into the treasury of the Lord. So the people shouted, and priests blew the trumpets, and when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted with great shout, and the wall fell down flat. So the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. They utterly destroyed everything in the city, both man and woman, old, young and old, and ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, go into the harlot's house and bring the woman and all she has out of there, as you have sworn to her. So the young men who were spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brothers and all she had. They also brought out all her relatives and placed them outside the camp of Israel. They burned the city with fire and all that was in it. Only the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. However, Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all she had, Joshua spared. She has lived in the midst of Israel to this day, for she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. And Joshua made them take an oath at that time, saying, cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds the city Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn, he shall lay its foundation. With the loss of his youngest son, he shall set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. By the way, archaeologists do say that there was a time when the wall of Jericho fell down. And the city was burnt at the same time. I mean, it was burnt thoroughly. Burnt in a way that conquerors of that day didn't burn it. I mean, there were jars full of grain that were burned. Generally, when you set siege to a city in those days, you didn't do that. You took the grain. You didn't burn it. The only thing archaeologists quarrel about is the dates. I mean, they talked a week or so ago that some people have wildly different dates for the destruction of Jericho and the exodus out of Egypt. But basically God worked a miracle on this, that right at the point when they shouted, right at the point when they blew the shofar, the walls went down flat. And that big, terrible, fortified city, it was all shut up with no way in or out. Now it's just a wide open city without any walls for protection. And Joshua's men could march right up into it. And once they did that, the party was over, because first of all, the people would have been terrified with the falling of the wall. I know I certainly would have been. And second of all, that you had the Jewish army at that point was substantial, but it just couldn't do anything with the walls of Jericho. And once again, God had commanded Joshua to do this. God himself could have easily wiped out the city had he wanted to. A relatively small size meteor aimed expertly could have handled it, or a plague, or they could have just all dropped dead, or been, you know, transported miraculously to the airless surface of the moon, or whatever else you'd think that God could do with the city. But instead, he had the army of Israel do this. It's all about, you know, we can get tied into the performance of the plan as we see it, but God's plan is intimately connected with the perfection of the people. And when we look at the strategy and the objectives, the strategy and the objectives are secondary to what he's accomplishing in the heart of the people in terms of their trust in God, their allegiance to Joshua, and their trust in what God has put forward for them to do. And so too in our day, we can get tied up in the success of the plan. I'm going to go out. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And so we measure success by, you know, if we have serving the Lord, the size of this, or the number of hits on a website, or the number of people on our mailing list, or the size of the Bible study, or all the rest of this. But that's not how God measures things. He's not about that. He's about the way it works in the hearts of people. We also need to be part of, and that the first point goes all the way to the end, and that is to be part of God's program, not expecting to draft God into being part of yours. Because God's not, he doesn't say, well, I'm stuck here, I'm going to have to ask Pete for advice on how to handle this thing. No, never, ever, ever happen. All of us are, it's in comparison to the God who created the whole universe. Comparisons fail us. You know, you look at the comparison between a hamster and us is pretty wide. You don't ask for a hamster to help you with your geometry homework, but at least not if you're sane. But the gulf between us and hamsters is but a small thing compared to the gulf between us and God. I mean, God is just, we are, the only thing we can compare ourselves with is created beings, and God is the creator instead of the created. And so we need to be on board with his plan. We need to be doing it his way, whether it makes sense to us or not. And we need to be ready at the end to be asked to participate in the plan, not because God himself could not accomplish it, but rather that God's desire is that he do a work in us, as well as that piece of the plan that we are participating in. That piece of the plan includes changing our heart. So by being part of what we perceive as the plan, the greater plan of perfecting us is underway. And we just don't have, we just don't have the intelligence to figure it all out. It's like when you get to the end of your life and stand before God, if you still have the desire to find out something, why in the world this happened, I'm sure the answer is not going to be a simple one. It might be something like, well, why in the world did my car get smushed the other day? Well, it might be because by smushing the car, there was somebody, you know, 78 cars back who happened to look up as they were passing the accident and maybe thought for a brief second about their own mortality. So when they got to work, somebody wanted to talk to them about the Lord, and they said okay, when they never would have otherwise. You just never know. Or it might be that somebody who is just, you know, involved with physical things and really loving the things of this world meditated for a bit as they saw the accident passing, how fleeting the things of this world are. And you just never know. The purposes go deep and they go very, very subtle. And they're part of the overall plan. At one point in my life, no shocking revelation here, but, well, maybe to some people, I used to do counted cross stitch. I still have some things around, but, you know, I started 30 years ago and never finished. But when you're doing some sort of work like that, you have all these crazy colors, like some of these stupid kits tell you to take, you know, one strand of this color and the other strand of that color and put them together to make something that's just a little bit different than the other colors. You scratch your head and say, what in the world is that all about? Because counted cross stitch, you're making stitches on individual intersections of fabric that some of it's as fine as 22 stitches to the inch in a canvas that's maybe, you know, 12 by 24 inches. So you put that first stitch down and you say, that doesn't look like anything. You put the next stitch down and you say, that still doesn't look like anything. And maybe, you know, 50,000 stitches later, you can finally say, oh yeah, now I know what that looks like. Now I can see that the designer really knew what he or she was doing, and it looks really nice. And the individual moments of our lives are smaller than those little stitches. It's God's putting together the overall picture of our life. And we can't see what it looks like until it's all done. And when it's all done, then God can tell us what it looks like. Because it gets even better than that, because after we're done the stitches of our lives, we have to stop and realize that that's just the tiniest little stitch in God's plan. And so understanding our life, we can't really understand our life until we understand all those lives around us are impacted. I'm sorry, I'm speaking for myself, and forgive me if I take you along on this, that we're too stupid to figure it out all by ourselves. But God's got it all. He's got it all together. He's got the individual moments of billions of people understood and planned out and all solidly on track on his plan. It's not like this little red light goes on his dashboard and he says, uh-oh, somebody's off my plan. But it all is working together. And whether we like it or not, we're part of God's plan. But hopefully, it's a plan for good for us as we are on God's side of things and not trying to fight the plan. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, I thank you for the ways you have used us. Thank you for the great blessing of redemption in our lives. I thank you for the ways you have worked in us to refine us and purify us. I ask that you would continue to give us wisdom, that we might really understand the place that we have in your plan for blessing, and not for judgment, not for discipline, so that we might be perfected and that your name might be glorified through us and the name of our Messiah, Yeshua, might be lifted up. Amen.